Matt and I were chatting in this week. It's a very rare occasion that we get to do that, but we were. And we spoke about how many people we knew who were facing huge problems in their life. I don't mean the kind of insignificant time after time things. I mean massive life problems. We knew someone who is facing a child with long-term illness who probably going to die before they reach adulthood. We know some people who are dealing with horrific treatment in their past. You know, people with family problems on a huge scale. As we started to talk about them, it wasn't ones and twos. I mean, if you added up our church friends and our friends outside of the church, it was like 50 or 60 people. In fact, the majority of people we knew had not just everyday problems, but massive problems in their lives. And we realised as we talked that that's what life is like. Life isn't easy, not even mildly difficult. Life is full of gigantic problems. Problems that are so huge they seem absolutely insurmountable. Can't get over them. The story we look at today provides the perfect metaphor for that. It's David versus Goliath. The small versus the large. The weak versus the strong. But this story doesn't just frame our problem that we're small against a strong enemy. It also gives us great hope. Because little Goliath, little David, was defeated by defeated great Goliath. Let me get that and say that again. Little David defeated great Goliath. And if that's possible, isn't it possible that the gigantic problems that we face day by day can be defeated by David's great God? That's the hope of this passage. We're going to walk through it in four steps. We're going to look at the enemy that David faced and that we faced. We're going to look at the hero. We're going to look at the weapons. And then we're going to look at the victory. As we understand how David defeated Goliath, we're going to understand how God can defeat the things that rage against us as well. So first of all, the enemy. And we see that in verses 1 to 11. We start the story in Judah. And the Philistines have turned up again. They've kind of been out of the story for a couple of chapters. But if you remember, they are the enemies of Israel. The ones who stole the Ark of the Covenant a few chapters back. They were beaten, but not destroyed by Saul. And now they're back with a vengeance. And the picture is of a great valley. The Philistines are lined up on one side of the valley. And the Israelites are lined up on the other side of the valley. Now, if you know anything about war, if you've got the high ground, you don't want to come down from it. There's a massive disadvantage. So if the Israelites came down from their high ground and started to charge up the other side of the valley, they were going to be slaughtered. So there was a bit of an impasse. These two armies stood facing each other, waiting to see who would come first. And out marches a champion. Now the word's literally a man of the in-between. So he goes into the no man's land in between and bellows out his challenge. That's Goliath. He is massive. Now, it's a bit hard to be sure exactly to the centimetre or the inch how big he is. You've got to remember in those days they didn't have rulers. It's a lot easier to compare in the New Testament measurements to today's measurements. But these were quite informal measurements. So just like back in the good old days, a foot was literally you measuring by foot, which obviously varied depending on whether you're a size 13 or a size 3. Well, similarly, a cubit isn't a particularly precise measurement. Some reckon that he's as big as 9'9". The Greek translation of the Old Testament, which obviously is translated by Hebrew speakers, puts him at 6'9". Now, given the size of his armour, it's probably the upper end of the scale rather than the lower end of the scale. And we know the Bible speaks of people who live for a long time, like Noah, earlier in history, and it also speaks of people who were excessively tall as well. So it might be that he is bigger than a human would be today. But whichever is right, whether he's 6'9" or he's 9'9", he is intimidatingly big. And he comes out with the height of technology. He has bronze armor, a special javelin, which he's able to sort of pull back towards him, a huge shield. And you might remember from last time that most of the Israelites are coming out to fight with farm tools because they didn't have a blacksmith. And he strides out into the middle and booms a challenge to break the stalemate. Verse 8. Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and servers. And the Philistine said, this day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight together. So this is an idea of breaking that deadlock. It's not fair for any one side to come down from their high ground. So why don't two men meet in the small space in the middle? The best of the Philistines versus the best of the Israelites. And whichever one wins, the others will be their slaves. It's pretty obvious who the Philistines want. They want Goliath. And it should be pretty obvious who's going to fight for Israel. Who's the tallest of the Israelites if you've been here for the past few weeks? Who's the one who was appointed to fight their battles for them? Saul. But here's Saul's response, verse 11. On hearing the Philistines' words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Saul's not able to fight this battle. No one in Israel feels able to fight this battle. The enemies are overwhelming. Now, as we said at the start, there are plenty of Goliaths we face in our lives. Problems so great they seem impossible to conquer. My family is falling apart. What am I to do to overcome that? As someone I love is in the grip of incredible pain, how can I help them? My own body is slowly wasting away. What do I do in this stage of my life? And then there's what the Bible identifies as our greatest problems, even bigger than those temporary things we have to face. Satan himself marches around like Goliath, trying to do whatever it takes to get us to turn away from the living God. Then there's the persecution of the world. Unlike any other situation in life, Christians get an immense amount of pressure, and we know of many Christian brothers and sisters across the world who face it far harder than we do. And then there's a sin inside of us, the part of us that is still drawn to a life away from God. And of course, that sin rightly deserves to be punished by him. Practically puts us, well, it does put us on the side of the Philistines rather than the Israelites. We're rightly terrified and dismayed as we look at these things, thinking, I can't win this battle. Now, maybe we would be looking to some Saul to come out and defend us. We know we're not strong enough to fight those battles, but maybe there's someone who can help us. If we go to the doctors and he gives us the right medicine, well, then we'll be okay. It turns out that the condition you have is untreatable. Or you turn to a trusted friend and you think, well, maybe they'll have an idea of what I should do. And they are just clueless, have no idea, feel even a bit intimidated by being asked to help you. Maybe you go to the so-called experts in all areas of life and you try all their advice and it just doesn't seem to work. What can I do, you ask? You're terrified, you're dismayed. The giant looms over you, ready to destroy. That's our enemy. And what we need is a hero, a champion, someone who will stride out into the no man's land and fight on our behalf. Well, we meet the champion for the Israelites in verses 12 to 30, and that's David. Now, the hero isn't who you'd expect. All the army are lined up on the side. But if you imagine David and Goliath as a film, suddenly there's a sharp cut, and we go from this battleground to the fields of Israel, where there's a young man caring for some sheep. It couldn't be a starker difference. David is not in this battle, and the reason is because of his age. Now, we're not told what his exact age is at this point, but he's clearly not old enough to fight. It's reckoned that fighting age would have been about 20, and so he's probably somewhere between 16 and 19. So he's not a little boy, as you might get the impression of in sort of the story Bibles, but he's certainly not bulked up enough to go to war. He's looking after the sheep, and then he's eventually sent on some menial errand by his dad. So he's not the hero we're looking for. As he goes off to deliver some food to his brothers, he goes on this 12-mile trek. He arrives there and he tries to find his brothers to just see how they're getting on, to give his dad some assurance. After all, Goliath, we're told, has been out there every day for 40 days, morning and evening. And you can imagine that without news, the father would have got a bit worried about what may have happened to his sons. But when he gets there, he overhears Goliath saying that same old speech that he said every day. Verse 24 reminds us what the impact of this is. Whenever the Israelites saw the man, they all fled from him in great fear. So the Israelites are terrified. 40 days worth of this challenge, and they're not any more confident than they were on day one. And we also get a reminder of how Saul's feeling about this. Verse 25, the Israelites are all gossiping between themselves. Do you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his family from taxes in Israel. I.e., Saul is definitely not going to go and fight this battle, and he's willing to throw however much money he has to go and get someone else to do the job for him. But David's very different. He hears this shout coming from the Philistine, and he says, verse 26, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? Far from fearful, David is shocked that nobody has gone and taught him a lesson already. Now, Eliab, his older brother, gets a little bit of a hump about this. It's one of those parts where you can tell that the Bible's a real story because it really does sound like an older brother and an eighth youngest brother having a bit of an argument. Eliab thinks that David is just there to watch the battle when he should be at home doing the important work of looking after the sheep. But as David talks about this, people overhear him and they're going to take him to Saul, which we'll come back to in a second. But this is the one who's going to win the battle. Put it all together. He's too young to fight and probably too weedy at this stage of his development. He's a shepherd. He's an errand boy. He's bossed around by his dad and his older brother. This is the one that God's going to use to slay Goliath. He's the very opposite of the hero you'd expect. And that's the way God always works. He never takes the obvious route. What would have made sense would have been someone strong enough to fight. Maybe a gigantic man like Saul to match Goliath or at least stand up to him. Or maybe Eliab, at least a little bit older and stronger and able to fight. No, David is sent. And that's classic God stuff, isn't it? Again and again, he uses the unexpected hero to show who's really going to win the victory. And it's the same with us. The one to rescue us from those giants in our lives. The giant of Satan, the giant of sin, the giant of death and suffering in this present world is Jesus. And as we've said in recent weeks many a time, there's nothing impressive to look at in Jesus. He's not strong, he's weak as he dies on the cross. He didn't have political power. He was a homeless man wandering around Israel. But in him was the power of God. Now on a Sunday, it's easy to nod our heads at that. Really believe it? When those giants are raging in your life, do you really believe Jesus is enough? can sing songs about him, you can lead Bible studies about him, but do you really believe that he is the solution to your deepest problems? Particularly those of you who aren't following him yet. I suspect the reason you're here week after week is because there's something about Jesus that draws you. But there's also a part of you that's saying, this can't be it. Following Jesus can't be enough. It's got to be something else. There's far too much going on in my life for someone like Jesus to help me. That's how God works. He works through the seemingly insignificant hero to win his great victory. And this morning, if you'll turn to him as the hero that you'd never expect, you truly need. We've seen the enemy. We've seen the hero. And now, in verses 31 to 40, we come to the weapon. How is David going to conquer? Well, ultimately, the weapon David relies on is God himself. David gets taken to Saul, and he announces in verse 32, "Let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him." Well, you can imagine that there were chuckles in the room. Some arrogant teenage boy decides that he can do what nobody else in the army can do. It's all summed up by Saul in verse 33. "You're not able to go out against the Philistine and fight him. You're only a young man, and he's been a warrior from his youth. In football terms, he's playing for the first team, and you're still in the under-10s. Or you're a first-year medical student, and you're asking me to do brain surgery. There's no chance. You are not strong enough for this." But David knuckles down in verse 34 to 37. "Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of the Philistine." Now, it might sound on an initial read like what David's doing is he's trying to give like his CV of fighting. It's like, well, I might not have been in a battle, but I'm taking out a bear. But actually what he's doing is summarized in that last line. "The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion will rescue me again." You see his point? He's not saying, "Saul, you've underestimated me. I am strong enough to take out this Philistine." He's saying, "No. God, who saved me then, will save me again." And Saul's response shows that he understands what David's getting at. "Go and the Lord be with you." But remember, there's something else about Goliath. He's not just big, but he's got the height of technology. He's got bronze weapons. And David's going to need the same, surely. You've got to make it at least kind of a fair fight. And so Saul gets out his armor. If you remember from a few chapters ago, there's only him and Jonathan in the whole of Israel who have bronze armor. David refuses them. And not because, as in the little story Bibles, they're too big for him and he's wandering around with a massive hat on his head, but because he doesn't know how to use them. He doesn't need these bronze weapons. He's going to go to the river, he'll get 5 smooth stones, and he'll trust that God will help him. Now again, that's ridiculous. It's like going up against a tank with a slingshot. But David's faith isn't in his weapons, it's in the Lord. Now Jesus had that same confidence. He promised that he would defeat everything that was in enmity against God. Promised to solve the separation between man and God forever. He promised to end death. He promised to overcome human sinfulness. He promised to end suffering once and for all, wipe every tear from our eyes, to renew the whole heavens and the earth. And he was going to do that by dying on a cross. Do you really believe that's the way Jesus is going to rescue this world? Do you believe that your sin, as gigantic as it is, as uncontrollable as it is paid for by Jesus on the cross? Do you believe that whatever suffering you face now will be gone in eternity because of what he has done Do you believe that he has the power to take all of the things in this world that hurt us and throw them away for eternity? Jesus has that power because he fights not with the weapons of this world, not with politics or incredible leaders or anything like that. He conquers by the power of his work on the cross. That's Jesus' slingshot, and he can slay any giant with that power. Let's end with the victory, verses 41 to 58. What happens to the one who trusts God, to our hero? Well, Goliath starts coming, marching down the hill. You can imagine the stomp, 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 the silence of the armies. He's heard that the Israelites are sending out someone this day. Who's it going to be? Is Saul finally going to man up and face him? Is there some other champion they've got in the background? What does he see? Verse 42, he looked over, looked David over and saw that he was little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome, and he despised him. Now you might think that that sounds pretty complimentary, but I think the blokes in the room know that if there's going to be a fight, if there's a pretty boy on one side, that's not the one you're going to back. That's what David is thinking. He's looking at this perfectly handsome, pretty little boy, and thinking, I am going to smash his face in. He's not got a chance against me. I have been in battle after battle. This boy hasn't even got a scar on his cheek. He can't believe it. 40 days, 40 nights, shouting out, and this is it. This dog is what they send against him. That's what he says, doesn't he? Am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? And the Philistines cursed David by his gods. Come here, he said, and I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals. It's a bit like the weigh-in at a boxing match. There's a lot of trash talk that's happening at this point. But the key part is, he cursed David by his gods. So this isn't just a battle between David and Goliath. This is a battle between Yahweh, the God of the Israelites, and Dagon and the rest of the Philistine gods. That's the battle. And David responds with the best trash talk in history. You come against me with sword and spear and javelin. But I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it's not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, but the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. Goliath had enough. He approaches to attack. David, younger, more nimble, he rushes, gets into position, puts his stone in his sling, swings it round, and first shot, even though he had five stones, first shot right between the eyes, he knocks Goliath dead. Goliath is hit, he falls face down on the floor, reminiscent of Dagon, the god, remember? Bowing down before Yahweh in the temple. And so we read, verse 50, David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. Well, he takes Goliath's sword, cuts off his head, takes it home, he's going to use that in the future. Philistine response is to run to the hills. They don't keep their end of the bargain and become slaves. They leg it. The Israelites charge after them and win a great victory. David's promise is fulfilled. And all the glory goes not to David. He only had a sling and a stone. He was a little boy. Now the battle is the Lord's. And so the victory is his as well. Now with our king, we see a victory too. There's two aspects really of Jesus' victory. One is when he rose from the dead and he showed once and for all that he can defeat our enemies of Satan, sin and death. But the final victory is still to come, isn't it? Satan is still functioning in the world. One day he's going to be thrown into the pit to suffer for eternity and he'll deserve every second of it. And one day the world that rebels against God will be thrown there as well. One day, the sin that still exists in your heart will be burned away, and only the Spirit will remain. The battle is the Lord's, and he will win, but we haven't seen it yet. So we're in a situation a bit like Israel in this passage, aren't we? David marching out to Goliath. We're trusting that as Jesus marches out to face Satan, sin, and death, and the power that he already has from the cross, he will conquer. We're trusting that Satan's power that he constantly tempts us with now will one day reach its end if we hold on. We're trusting that sin's grip on our lives will be loosened and we will persevere and sin no more for eternity. We're trusting that all the suffering and death in this life, every tear in our eye will be wiped away. Here comes this man who died 2,000 years ago on a cross. He's coming soon, and that is our hope, victory. God has told us that the victory is coming. Jesus, like David, has confidently said that God will do this. So what's our response going to be? Well, our response is to trust him. We repent of our fearfulness. The fact that we think Goliath is going to win this victory. That Satan, that sin, that death are going to win. And we trust him to win the victory. Now, some of you haven't done that yet. You're off to face Goliath on your own, or you're trembling in the camp. But if you trust Jesus, the victory will be won. Come to him and ask him to rescue you this very day. As for the rest of us, what do we do with the one who wins such a great victory? Well, Saul gave David all the rewards that he could find. He's trying to pin down who David's father is so that he can make sure that Jesse gets the reward. It just shows how insignificant David is that he's forgotten that he was playing the harp for him a few years previously. He gives him all the rewards he can give because that's what he deserves, because he is the hero who rescued Israel. And that should be our response as well. Jesus is that hero who is going to defeat all the giants that rage against us. Well, then we need to give him our lives, our service, our praise. Because he is the one who's won the final victory.